the fourth part of the jigsaw puzzle, we've looked at the question, war, trade and empire, agriculture and industry. Behind industry and agriculture is something deeper. This, we're going on a journey, and we take this step, and then we realize we have not solved the problem. Why was industry and agriculture so successful in England? It wasn't just the geography of England, and that it was an island, and that the people were lazy and preferred to let wind and water and animals do the work for them. Why did they develop coal mines, for example? China had lots of coal, massive coal. Japan had coal. The Ruhr Valley in Germany and France had huge coal, which was later exploited. You can't explain the use of coal by the fact that it's in the ground. There are other factors. So why did the English use coal at all? And so you need to broaden it out into the question of capitalism, money and markets, which is what I will now talk about. In other words, it's not a matter of technology, it's a matter of attitudes and relationships. It's not, as Marx realized, the forces of production, the technology, but it's the relations of production, the way people are related to each other in relation to resources. And so I would like to now look at the origins of capitalism. When Max Weber considered the origins of capitalism, he said that England is the first capitalist nation. And Marx more or less agreed with him. And I agree too. If you want to look at the origins of modern capitalism, it is England. And I'll explain why that is in a minute. But I'll show you one or two aspects of it. The first is the nature of property in England. When I'm trying to explain to my students, I used to think that property was an object, like this pen here. This is my property, or Tsinghua University's property. This thing. This, as Marx pointed out, is fetishization. It's making a fetish or something which doesn't really exist of this pen. Property is a relationship in a thing. So if you have this pen, property is not that pen. If this pen was lying out on the road, it would not be property of anybody. But here, you have certain rights in that pen. I have the right to draw on this board. So Prof. MacFarlane has what we call use rights. I can use this pen. Tsinghua University has ownership of this pen. If I take it away, I will be stealing it. It actually belongs here. It's no problem, I hear, but I wouldn't dare steal it all the same, because it is not mine. It belongs to Tsinghua, though they have kindly let me use it. It might be, so Tsinghua, if they like, they can sell this pen or give it to another person. So it is there. And property is usually held by many, many different people in an object. And other times it's just held by one person. If you have full individual property, as is conceived of in advanced capitalism, you have all kinds of rights in it. But in most societies, there are different rights. For example, in many tribal African societies, a woman is considered as the property of different people. Her husband has certain rights, sexual rights. He expects his wife to cook for him, and so on. But her parents will have other rights in her. Her children will have other rights in her, the wider kinship groups. So you have what is called a bundle of rights in a thing. Sometimes they're all bundled together, and then you have extreme private property. But usually you have different rights. So property is ultimately about a relationship between a thing, and it doesn't need to be a physical thing. It can be what's called immaterial property or symbolic property. It might be, for example, in England, that a college, a church in England would be partly in the property of a Cambridge college. So King's College can decide who is going to be in charge of that church. That is the right of the college. So that's an immaterial right. And these rights can be transferred and held in all sorts of complex ways. In the majority of societies, above all, you have a group who share all different kinds of property together. And this is usually the case in peasant societies and familistic societies. That is the family. All of the people, the mother, the father, the mother, and their children. If you say to, this is their family farm, say in Sichuan or wherever it is, and you go to one of them, you go to the son, and you say, okay, this is your family farm, which bit of it is yours? He'll look at you and say, well, all of it's mine. And you'll say, well, can you sell it to me? He said, of course I can't sell it to you. It's all mine, but it's also all my parents and my brothers and the whole family. We own it together. We don't have separate rights in it. And then you say to him, well, when your parents die, will you get this farm? And he'll say, of course I will. Yeah, because when I was born, I was part of the group who owned it. We have a right from birth to a share of this property. So in these societies, property is considered to go down as a lump, owned jointly together. Strangely, I think a lot of the best work in the field of kinship and so on was done by academics from Oxford and Cambridge, and I think part of the reason was that in a way, being a member of a Cambridge or Oxford college gives you some sense of what corporate, as it's called, corporate, that's a body, property, feels like. Because as a fellow of King's College, Cambridge, I have, this is the chapel here, so there's the chapel and there's the lawn and then there's other buildings. As a fellow, I am one of the 100 people, like a family, who own this place. We own it jointly. So I can sit in this chapel, I can drink the wine, I can walk across the grass. But like a family, I don't own it individually. If someone said, well, could you cut up a bit of the grass and give it to me? Or which bit of the grass is yours? I'd say, well, no bit of the grass is mine, the whole grass is mine, but it's also the other fellows of the college and the same with the chapel and everything else. So we have an idea of corporate property. Now the thing which I'll come back to is that in England there was no family property. It's absolutely central to understand English culture and society. We never had anything like this. This differentiates England from every other civilization in history, except, to a certain extent, Japan, which had something slightly different, and later, of course, America. In England, you have private property. Here am I. I have my car, I have my television set, I have my house, my garden. The only person with whom I share this, who has joint property to a certain extent with me, is my wife. She might also have her own private property to which I have no access at all. We never joined our property in England, unlike France and elsewhere. So she might have her own car or her own investments or whatever it is. But we may share a good deal. We may have bought things together and so on, built up some communal property. But that is all. That is the only property owning group in the family. Our children, in our case, three daughters, don't have any rights in our property, just as we have no rights in our parents' property. They may have expectations, they may hope that when we die, we will give them some of our property. But it's up to us. We don't have to. There's a famous Latin saying in the greatest law book of England, Bracton. The Latin is nemo est heres viventis, and it means no one is the heir of a living person. As long as a person is alive, they have no automatic heirs, because they can, until the moment of their death, just sell off, give away, destroy, do what they like. It is theirs. So you get in Dickens' novels and elsewhere, famously, scenes at the deathbed when everyone is sitting around wondering who has got the family property, or a bit. The will is read out, and the will says, I leave my this to this and this, and people say, oh, I thought I would get something, but I've got nothing. You can just will away or give away your property. And this has been a feature of England from at least the 12th century, nearly 1,000 years. And it is one of the deep causes of English capitalist insecurity, because you cannot expect, the moment you are born, your parents are implicitly telling you, it is up to you. Don't expect that we owe you anything. Obviously, we would, if we love you, we will give you things, but it is not a right. It's the dynamics that is behind one of Shakespeare's greatest plays, King Lear, where King Lear demands, in reverse, of his daughter Cordelia, her love. He says, tell me you love me and you will look after me. Now, she does love him, but she cannot be ordered to love him. So this works both ways. We don't automatically leave our property to our children. And likewise, they have no obligation. We have no rights in them. If I am old and poor and my children are rich and famous, they may help me. They probably will not look after me, but they may help me in small ways. But that is up to them. I have no right to demand anything from them. So property and the individualistic property system of England is at the core of capitalism. So when China recently relaxed and changed its property laws to allow, because of course communism tries to destroy all this private property and create totally a joint or communal property, when property was, the laws were changed in China recently to allow people to have private property, it's gone, moved a good step towards a capitalist system. But there is still huge history of familistic sentiments and ideas and no doubt laws, which means that it is not fully capitalist in this sense. That's one aspect of capitalism. A second aspect is even deeper, the capitalist ethic. The idea of the capitalist ethic obviously reflects Max Weber's work. And Weber realized that capitalism is not a matter of outward things. It is an attitude. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of perceiving the world and acting in the world. And you can't judge it by external things. It is an attitude towards time. What do you do with your time? Do you save it or do you spend it? Do you go out and have a good time or do you work a little harder? It's an attitude towards profit. Do you try, when you are making a transaction, do you try and maximize profit, economic profit, or do you try and maximize social profit? Do you sell to your family cheaply because you would like to be nice to your family, or do you strictly adhere to maximization of market profit? Do you live in luxury, or do you live very carefully and simply? And one of Max Weber's greatest insights was that if you think of in terms of spirit, you can't tell from the outside form of a civilization whether it is capitalist or not. He realized perfectly well that every society is a little bit capitalist. The simplest hunter-gatherer, you know, wants to make a little bit of profit and so on. It's there right from the beginning of human civilizations. But his great insight was that until the 14th, 15th century or later, most civilizations were non-capitalist because their attitudes were basically that if you made money, you consumed it, you spent it, you built large palaces, you distributed it, you gave it to your relatives. You didn't save and try and make maximum profit. And so he contrasts the great rich civilizations of, which look so capitalist, like Florence, like Venice, like 17th, 18th century France, like Versailles, and so on. He says those are not really capitalist. They're very rich, they're very wealthy, people make a lot of money, but money is not capitalism. Wealth is not capitalism, it's the attitude. So you have Florence on one side, and you have backwoods America, some forest in Pennsylvania, where some little man is sitting in a log cabin, scribbling away his thoughts. His name is Benjamin Franklin. And he's saying, must get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, must work very hard, must save this, must do that. His attitude is capitalist, even though he lives in the middle of a forest. And I think once you realize this distinction, you can see that, and then you apply it, you can understand why England was a capitalist society from very early on, even though it wasn't the wealthiest by any means. Many other countries in Europe were wealthier until the 17th, 18th century. It was a small country with a lot of animals, sparse population, small towns, very rural looking, like Pennsylvania. On the other hand, China was filled with wealth and display and much larger cities, but it wasn't capitalist. Because if you look at the diaries, the letters, the attitudes of the English from very early on, you find that they are concerned with making money, improving their lives, being careful, being truthful, sober, honest, all the virtues of what Max Weber called the Protestant ethic, well before Protestantism. This, of course, has been often pointed out in relation to Max Weber's famous thesis, that the Protestant attitude doesn't suddenly occur with the Protestant Reformation in 16th century England. It's there well before. It's found, of course, in Holland as well. And it means that you have a civilization which has gone on for 1,000 years where you are constantly trying to improve yourself and improve the material world around you. And so you have constant striving, constant moving towards something. The reasons for this I'll talk about in a later lecture on social class, because I don't think that Weber was absolutely right in thinking it was religious anxiety about being saved or being damned. What was the anxiety in England was really this, that from birth you have no fixed position. Your parents cannot help you, and you cannot expect them to do so. You are alone. You are, every Englishman and every English woman is like Robinson Crusoe. Karl Marx used Robinson Crusoe in Das Kapital as his image of modern individualistic society, quite rightly, because Robinson Crusoe is like the typical Englishman. And of course, the book was written by one of the greatest English commentators on capitalism, Daniel Defoe. Robinson Crusoe, if some of you know that book, was someone who was wrecked on a desert island. No one else was there. He got some things off his ship. So he had to start, as every English person has to do, with almost nothing. Things that he'd just taken from the ship, a few things, passed on, he managed to save. In other words, his education, equivalent of his education. And then he gradually, he grew a little more, and he made a little more, and gradually he built up his world until he was reasonably well off. That is the story or the parable of every English child, even today. And it's so different from many civilizations, as I'll talk about later. Another aspect of this is that land in capitalist society is just one other factor of production. It has no real meaning in itself. It is a commodity in Marx's sense. It is something which you use to make money with. And this is totally different from peasant societies, China, India, France, Poland, wherever you like. In such societies, you have, as a peasant in Yunnan or wherever it is, you have your rice fields, and the family own this as a joint venture, and it goes on from generation to generation. Your ancestors have had it, they have been buried on the corner of it. It's gone down those generations, you now have it, and it goes on to your children and your grandchildren. And the aim of every good peasant is to keep the name of that peasant family, on that land. It's an English-Irish expression, keeping the name on the land. You mustn't sell it, you mustn't lose it. If possible, you should try and increase it, get another bit of land there, and then you'll be a little bit richer. So you mustn't move away, you mustn't lose the family land, otherwise you'll have nothing. Now that is completely the opposite of the English attitude. The English attitude is, you may move into a house and have some land, as my wife and I do in Cambridge, and you may love it very much. You may plant trees there and have a garden and have a tea house and spend many happy hours in it. But it isn't a family matter. When you die, you know your children will probably sell it and buy a house elsewhere if you leave it to them, which you don't have to do. So our families don't stay in the same village or in the same house or in the same land. Farmers just use their land and then pass it on. Of course, if you're a very, very rich family owning a stately home, then it may be very possible that you would like one of your sons, and often they do for a few generations, Blenheim Palace or something like that, stay in a family. But even there, you often lose the male heirs and it gets sold off. So after 100, 200 years, it goes to another family. But amongst the 90% of the population, or more than that, below them, there is no sentimental attachment to a particular landholding. As Tocqueville said, the French peasant was so passionately fond of the soil that he consecrates all his earnings to its purchase and buys it at any price. In England, with the English, land is a luxury. It is honourable and agreeable to possess it, but it yields comparatively little profit. Only rich people buy it. And England has never been a land of peasants living on their land. In fact, England is the one civilization, more or less, which has never had peasants. The fact that we had to bring the word peasant from France, paysan, is because we don't have a word for traditional people living on the land and keeping their family on the land. Another feature is money lending. In a peasant society like this that I've described here, a peasant village, such as the ones that characterized much of France, Italy, or India and China, You'd have the little houses in the village here. And day to day, it's a non-monetized economy. That is to say, 90% of your transactions are through work and through goods. If you need something, you'll go to your neighbor and you say, I have too many potatoes or a bit extra rice, but I don't have a bit of cloth which I need. Can we exchange it? So you have exchanges between and a non-monetized economy. Money, this magical thing which will buy you almost anything and you can store up, is outside, is on periphery. That means that's fine for normal circumstances, but from time to time one of these families has some emergency where they need money. They need to pay the tax to the landlord. They have a daughter getting married. Someone is ill. There's a funeral. They suddenly need money. What do? Because no one here has any money. So what they do is they go to the local town, usually, and they find a money lender, or what we call a pawnbroker. You take your property and you put it in the shop, the man gives you some money, and then if you can come back with some money later, having paid a little extra, you can get your goods back. The Chinese lived off pawnbroking and money lending. And there is a whole class in all peasant societies in France and all the places I mentioned of professional money lenders. And in such situations, these people charge huge rates. In Nepal, where my wife and I work, if you borrow money from ordinary people, not from the bank traditionally, you would pay something like 2-3% per month, which works out as a compound interest rate of between 50 and 100% a year. Now that's a huge rate of interest on a loan. Partly reflects the insecurities, because many lenders know that many of their clients may not be able to pay. But it also reflects their power over poor peasants who are desperate and who need some money. In England, A, there were no moneylenders. There is no class of moneylenders. I've studied English villages and many English documents, and you don't find professional moneylenders. You find people, obviously, in villages and elsewhere, because in England, everyone has money. Almost every villager will have some money, either in his house or access to it. So money is not on the outside in an English village, it's on the inside. Relations between these, if you want some potatoes from someone, you go and buy it from them. If you want someone to come and work for you, you pay them with money. So in England, money has come right inside the village economy. It is, in other words, a market capitalist economy, right down to the level of the village and the household. And that means that if you want to borrow some money, you go to a friend or a neighbour and you say, will you lend me some money? And they say, okay, how much? Well, how about 10%? Okay, so, or you go to a bank or a small bank, and the characteristic rates of interest in banks and so on in England in this period is between 5 and 15%. In Holland, it was even lower. So basically, money lending is absent, and you have the penetration of cash at the local level. Finally, the last point I would like to, and these just indications of early capitalism, is the relation between the city and the countryside. In this contrast between normal peasant society like this, you have the country village here, and over here you have, usually in China, a walled city, As you know from Skinner's works, small city towns, bigger towns, cities in a complex pattern. But just say there is a city, this is a village here, and here is the city with the citizens living in it. In England, the attitude towards cities of English people, both those who live inside and who are in the countryside, is very odd. England became the most urban city-based civilization in history in the 19th century. Huge cities, Manchester, Liverpool, London, and so on. And it still is very urban. And yet we don't like cities. There is a strong anti-city mentality in England, and always has been, and probably always will be. As one Frenchman noted, the country is England's poetry, the town her prose, which is just the reverse of the opposition in Latin countries. One has but to think of the towns of Italy, for instance. If you go to Italy, which I hope some of you will do, you go to a city like Venice or Florence or Perugia or wherever, Siena. The cities are beautiful, usually with walls around them. And all of high life, art, sophistication, civilization comes from the Latin word for city, civitas. Civilization is the city. This is where all the rich and powerful, intelligent academics from Tsinghua and others live here. These people live in a different world. They're uneducated, they're dirty, smelly, they work hard in the fields. They're almost like animals. And in almost all civilizations, there has been this strong contrast with all the powerful people living there and these people doing all the work and paying taxes in the cities. That's what you would find if you look at portraits and paintings in European art galleries of Italy, Spain, Portugal, and so on. In England, on the other hand, something very strange happened from very early on. Many people think it comes from Germanic society, where Germanic society people lived rather remotely in little remote villages. And this pattern continued through the ages. And so English life is ultimately, despite being lots of cities, ultimately rural. That's to say, an English person who, most English people, would like in the end of their lives to live in the countryside. It is the dream of many English people, if they were wealthy enough, to have a little cottage in a little village with honeysuckle growing up along the walls, thatched apple trees in the garden. And all English romantic poetry and elsewhere describes this dream of living in the countryside. If they can't do that, then they bring the countryside into their towns. So you find in many English towns, everyone tries to have a little garden and grow their special things in that garden. They like to have parks. They like to make their cities into the countryside. But they also make the countryside into cities, because it's an astonishing thing about England. If in 19th century France, you had gone off into remote peasant villages, you would have felt completely, as a middle-class person from, say, Paris, you would have felt a complete outsider. You couldn't understand how they talked. You were amazed at what they ate. They treated you as someone from outer space. In England, many of the rich and powerful lived in the countryside. Almost every village would have a replica of the English social structure within that village. So you would have the lord of the manor, who was well educated, been Oxford and Cambridge, who was maybe many of them in the Houses of Parliament or whatever. You'd have a lord of the manor, you'd have a gentleman, a gentry, lower gentry, you'd have wealthy yeomen, you'd have ordinary. So there would be educated, powerful people spread all over the countryside, in small towns and in villages and so on. And if you think of, say, Jane Austen's novels, lot of it, most of it is set in the countryside, as you know. The English, up till recently, the rich and powerful lived in their country houses. They went to London for the season, that is, for plays, and to meet their friends for a few months in the summer. But that was that. Their hearts and their power was in the countryside. That has never been the case in any other civilization. And it's had enormous effect, because it means that, for instance, it affects democracy, because it means that power is distributed over the whole country. It affects somewhere like China, because when it's thinking about how to introduce lower-level democracy in China, if you suggest, well, why don't you, as in England, make all the villages into little mini-democracies, people say, well, the people there, they haven't been educated at all. They don't know, they don't have the experience, the wealth, the training to start doing this yet. In England, this had been going on for a long, long time. So to conclude, England had never been a peasant society in the traditional sense. It was a society where money, investment, banking, rational profit calculation was widespread. It was all one market. You didn't have to pay money to move goods from one part of England to another, as you did in France and other continental countries. There were good water communications. Money was paid for jobs, widespread wage labour. That is to say, by the 13th century, something like 70% of the population who were working, or 60-70% who were working as agricultural labourers, they were working on the land, they were paid money. They weren't given goods, they were paid money. So you had widespread wage labour. And if you read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, for example, you see a recognisably modern capitalist mentality there. All this is based on a very complex legal system concerned with property, with mortgages, with banks, with loans, with financial dealings, with people going out to make money. And this had been going on for hundreds of years, and it becomes more and more evident with the founding of the Bank of England, the Stock Exchange, the East India Company, the large trading organisations. So that by the 18th century, when you get the Industrial Revolution, you already have 400 or 500 years of capitalist development. So the supposed capitalist revolution, which Weber and Marx talked about as occurring around the 15th, 16th centuries, is wrongly dated. It's certainly going in the right direction, but England was capitalist well before this. So when China now is trying to turn into a modern capitalist society, it has to realise that it takes a long time to build it up, just as it takes a long time to build up democracy. It's not something you can buy off the shelf. You can buy technologies off the shelf. You can modernise your technology. But to modernise your social institutions, your relations of production, your mentalities, does take time. I'm sure China can do it. Thank you.